ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 14th of March. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. One of the world's most popular social media platforms, TikTok, could soon be banned in the United States after US Democrats and Republicans voted overwhelmingly for a bill to crack down on the Chinese-controlled app. The move is fueled by concerns that the Chinese government could exploit user data and manipulate public opinion, even meddle in elections. But the bill now faces a more difficult road in the Senate after Donald Trump flipped from support to opposition. North America correspondent Barbara Miller has more.
170 million Americans are on TikTok. An estimated 7 million use the app to run a small business. Today, a few of them protested outside Congress as a bill passed the House that could see the app banned.
On this vote, the yeas are 352, the nays are 65.
There's broad bipartisan support for the bill. Republican Mike Gallagher is one of the authors.
TikTok is a threat to our national security because it is owned by ByteDance, which does the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party.
Democrat Seth Moulton is a co-sponsor.
I mean, look, in the middle of the Cold War, we wouldn't have allowed the Soviet Union to own CNN. That's really what we're talking about here.
The bill would force TikTok's Chinese owners to sell their share in the app within 6 months or see it banned from app stores and web hosting platforms in the US. President Biden has said he would sign it into law. That's despite Joe Biden's re-election campaign reaching out on TikTok to younger voters.
I passed the biggest law in history to combat climate change.
The thinking of the now presumptive Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has evolved over time. As president, he threatened to ban TikTok. In a CNBC interview this week, Donald Trump explained why he's now changed tune.
There are a lot of young kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it. There are a lot of users. There's, you know, a lot of good and there's a lot of bad with TikTok. But the thing I don't like is that without TikTok, you can make Facebook bigger. And I consider Facebook to be an enemy of the people, along with a lot of the media.
ByteDance has always disputed claims of foreign interference and says it's never shared user data with the Chinese government. TikTok says the move will damage businesses and infringe free speech rights. Ahead of the vote, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin accused the US government of bullying behavior. And said the U.S. would only hurt itself. The bill's passage in the Senate is far from guaranteed, and even then it would likely face legal challenges. Its potential impact, so far, more political than practical. This is Barbara Miller in Washington, reporting for AM.
Here in Australia, the tax office has started chasing old debts worth billions of dollars, and it's sparking concern amongst those who would struggle to pay and fear losing everything. The ATO says it's owed more than $15 billion from 1.8 million entities, largely consisting of individuals. But the figure could be higher once interest is applied to those debts. Here's Nassim Kadem.
After escaping an abusive partner more than a decade ago, Adriana Carrington felt her life was just getting back on track. She had worked through years of therapy, finally getting a mortgage for a new home and starting her own business. But she says the tax office then derailed her life, hitting her with an alleged tax debt dating back to the 2008-09 financial year.
Devastated, absolutely devastated.
She got the debt because she says her ex-husband set up a trust in her name years ago, which she never received income from, but which created a debt in her name. In 2015, the ATO deemed the 2008 debt, which at the time was about $15,000, as uneconomical to pursue. But late last year, the ATO resurrected Ms. Carrington's debt, along with alleged debts belonging to thousands of other Australians. With interest charges applied, Ms. Carrington's debt is now at $34,000 and growing.
It's been really hard, mentally really hard. I've spent a lot of time crying.
The ATO says it has no discretion under the law to waive these debts and that it's a matter for the federal government if it waives debts older than 2017. Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones is looking into the issue, but an ATO spokeswoman said in a written statement to ABC News that interest charges keep accumulating. She says the ATO will consider remission on interest charges for some cases. Independent MP Andrew Wilkie has likened the situation to the controversial Centrelink robo-debt scheme.
Where it is literally lost in history and the taxpayer doesn't know the basis for it, the accountant can't get to the bottom of it and get a good explanation, then surely there must be a point at which the ATO has failed to do its job and the money is lost to it.
Gail Freeman runs a small accounting firm in Canberra and represents taxpayers who are being pursued for old debts worth as little as a few cents and one who is now deceased. She says the law needs to be changed to waive these very old small debts and that the ATO needs to better communicate with taxpayers.
I would have thought again, you know, if they had a de minimis or had a way of saying, well, look, if the debt's under $5, $10, whatever it is, we won't try and recover it. I mean, it looks really embarrassing when an organisation like the ATO tries to recover 55 cents.
Anne K.S. Kumar is the founding director of the University of New South Wales Tax and Business Advisory Clinic, which provides free tax and business advice for people in financial distress. 10 of her clients have debt like this with the ATO, and she's worked to clear them. She says the law needs to be changed so people in serious hardship have their debts easily waived.
As you can imagine, the sense of anxiety and fear and helplessness is quite profound. When it comes to economic stability, particularly in the broader context of a post-pandemic cost of living crisis, it can have a tipping point effect on clients.
Many Australians are now waiting to hear what happens with their debts.
Nassim Kadem there. Australian farmers are painting a bleak picture of the industry's future, warning more and more farmers are unable to maintain their businesses because of the financial squeeze they're under from interest rates and the major supermarkets. The warnings have been presented to a Senate inquiry into supermarkets, where it was claimed Australia is facing a critical food security issue. Here's political reporter Evelyn Manfield.
For 20 years, Peter Graham has been a dairy farmer. It's in his blood. His family's been milking cows for five generations. But he's worried about the future of the industry.
You can't do it for love anymore. You can't. But we are. And that's what we're doing. We're doing it because we are generational farmers.
A Senate inquiry into supermarkets has heard the number of dairy farmers in Queensland is rapidly declining. In roughly 20 years, it's gone from 1,500 to 230. The industry is still hurting from when milk was being sold for just $1 a litre and production started to slide.
We are now down to close enough to 8 billion litres in Australia. In 2011, when a dollar a litre started, we were on 12.4 billion litres. So we are a crippling industry.
And Peter Graham reckons the number of dairy farmers in his area is only going to drop further.
There's currently 62 dairy farmers between Grafton and the Queensland-New South Wales border. Within 10 years, there will be half.
Errol Gerber gave up dairy farming last September, finally forced out by floods, drought, trouble finding staff, and not enough left from all his effort.
It was also the cost pressures, the pressures of input costs as opposed to what we were receiving.
Greens Senator Nick McKim, who's the chair of the Senate's supermarket inquiry, is troubled by what he's hearing and what this all means for the future of farming in general.
A lot of farmers have already left the sector, and more Australian farmers, particularly family farms, are considering giving it up and leaving farming. This is a critical food security issue for our country, and it is an extremely dangerous scenario where we are more and more reliant on global supply chains to fulfil the basic food and dietary requirements of Australians. This is a national crisis that we are facing.
The inquiry is also hearing about the pressures consumers are facing at the checkout.
I knew things were bad in Australia, but this inquiry is peeling back the veneer and revealing just how many Australians are under massive financial stress simply because of the price of food and groceries, overlaid with skyrocketing rents, increasing interest rates and increasing power bills.
There are concerns too that the high costs are leading to declining fruit and vegetable consumption.
We know that high prices are driving a lot of Australians to not only skip meals but to eat more unhealthily, which then of course puts further pressure onto our critical healthcare system down the track.
Labor Senator Louise Pratt, who's also on the committee, says that will need to be addressed.
If people are consuming less of that now because of the cost of living crisis, how do we build that back up again? How do we make sure that this changing climate where things are costing more doesn't result in an unhealthy trend in our society where we're not eating enough fruit and vegetables?
She believes part of the solution lies in revealing who gets paid what as produce travels from the farm gate to the checkout.
We are being told by consumers, by farmers, that they want to see transparency, that this will help them protect their businesses and protect consumers.
Farmer Peter Graham has his own warning for the big supermarkets.
Stop importing cheap products out of other countries, mainly New Zealand at the moment. Stop importing and let's support the Australian farm. Yeah, the consumer, they deserve the choice. But if we want Australia to flourish, we need to support the farm base.
Coles and Woolworths have both indicated they'll appear before the committee, which is expected to report in May.
Evelyn Manfield, our reporter there. Crime in regional Australia continues to be a serious issue for locals, and in New South Wales, the gap between crime rates in Sydney and the bush continues to grow. The Minns state government this week became the latest to announce reforms to try to tackle youth crime, but many say it's not enough. Romy Stevens filed this report.
Anglican Church Minister Simon Waller never thought he'd be robbed once, let alone four times. His Gunnedah home in the New South Wales northwest was broken into at the end of 2022 and his car was stolen.
My wife and I were woken up with a balaclavaed person standing in the doorway of our bedroom. When we were disturbed, he bolted and that's when we noticed the car was missing.
Earlier this year, his church was targeted three times. The break-ins have had a prolonged impact.
My wife felt quite threatened, so we actually had to rearrange our bedroom so she wasn't sleeping at the entrance to the room. She's also found it really difficult to get to sleep, and when we hear noises in the house, there's a hypervigilance.
Simon Waller's experience with crime in the state's regions isn't isolated. New analysis from the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research shows in 2023 the rate of property crime was almost 60% higher in the regions of New South Wales compared to Sydney. Boxar's Jackie Fitzgerald says for violent crime, the rate in regional New South Wales was 57% higher.
A long-standing feature of crime in New South Wales is that regional communities tend to experience higher rates of crime than in the city. But what we can see is that this gap has grown over time as crime reductions in Sydney have exceeded those in the regions over the past two decades.
Community groups and local politicians aren't happy and they want more attention given to the problem. The first step, they want an official inquiry examining regional crime. Jamie Chaffee's the chair of the Country Mayors Association. He says the problem is so widespread, it needs a thorough examination.
The only way to really get to the bottom of these issues and have a pathway for government to actually make meaningful change, we think, is to have an inquiry where the hearings are in regional communities.
At this stage, though, such an option is unlikely, as the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, isn't convinced it's the right step forward.
We believe we have enough information from Boxar, as well as the evidence from civic leaders, as well as those that work in the criminal justice system. More than enough evidence for us to act. We don't need greater or further inquiry.
The Premier this week announced a $26 million package to support community safety in regional areas with a focus on youth crime. As part of that, a pilot program will be set up in Moree, more than 170 kilometres north of Gunnedah. It will include new bail accommodation for young people, improved out-of-hour activities and additional resources for local and children's courts.
I want to make sure that interventions that we make in Moree are evidence-based, that we can get the results out of that community, and we can apply schemes that we know will work right across this state.
The government is also introducing legislative changes to strengthen bail laws and introduce a new offence to detract people from advertising their involvement in crime online. But experts such as Newcastle University criminologist Xanthi Mallett isn't sure this approach will help.
What we need to do is work with families early on when children are young before they even get involved in these antisocial behaviours. Give these young people those opportunities and stop that cycle.
The chair of the Country Mayors Association, Jamie Chaffee, says every level of society in regional areas is affected by the problem and patience is wearing thin.
It's crime right across the board and it's not one particular community but many of our communities.
That's County Mayors Association Chair Jamie Chaffee, ending that report by Romy Stevens. Emergency crews have worked through the night to free workers trapped in a Western Victorian gold mine. Two men were injured. One was freed overnight and flown to hospital with life-threatening injuries. The other is still trapped. It's again thrust the issue of mine safety into the spotlight, as Anna Pikett reports.
Paramedics were called to the Ballarat gold mine south of the city centre around 5 o'clock yesterday evening. A rockfall trapped dozens of miners. How deep? Victoria Police Acting Inspector Lisa McDougall explains.
The information we have is that the location of the incident is about 500 metres underground, about 3 kilometres into the mine. I can't comment on the intricacies of any particulars around where he is because the rescue teams are working to reach him safely.
Working throughout the night, emergency teams managed to get most of the miners out. Now they're trying to stabilise the scene. It's been an eventful time for Ballarat, an historic regional town about an hour and a half's drive west from Melbourne. The disappearance of mother of three, Samantha Murphy, the ensuing five-week search, and the naming of a Ballarat local as her alleged killer have sent shockwaves through the city. All that while dangerous fires raged through parts of the region in recent weeks. Mayor Des Hudson is urging the community to stick together.
Yeah, look, there are three significant events that have affected our community, but we are a resilient community. We look after one another and we come together to support one another. And I have no doubt that our community will absolutely do the same while this particular issue at the gold mine is being worked through.
Mine collapses happen with a dangerous frequency in Australia. Memories of the Beaconsfield gold mine collapse in 2006 still resonate. Todd Russell and Brant Webb were trapped underground for 2 weeks before their dramatic rescue. Arnold Dix is the president of the International Tunnelling and Underground Space Association. He helped free 41 Indian workers trapped in a mine last year. He's told Channel 9 what rescue workers would be doing now.
These are incredibly difficult conditions to be working in. There's been the collapse. The actual mine itself is blocked. The area that they're trapped in, this type of mining operation, is in what's known as a fault zone. I mean, rescuers will be literally, again, going millimetre by millimetre, again, making sure they don't trigger a collapse, again, making sure they're safe. It's like microsurgery they're doing at the moment to get this man out. Now, the good news is that of all the countries and all the places for this to happen, we are some of the, well, us and the South Africans, the best miners, the best rescue teams, the best emergency services.
Ballarat Goldmine declined the ABC's request for comment on the incident.
Anna Pikett there. And Federal Minister Bill Shorten was the head of the Australian Workers' Union during the Beaconsfield mine collapse in Tasmania. He also spoke to Channel 9.
Well, first of all, my thoughts are with the men who were on the shift yesterday afternoon. They will be shocked, they will be grieving. And my thoughts are also with the rescuers who, no doubt as we speak, are doing their absolute best to find their final missing workmate. So that's what I think. I think about the people involved there.
Bill Shorten there. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Decades ago, when other countries were embracing nuclear power, Australia put a ban on it. Now the federal opposition wants to lift that ban and build nuclear power plants on the sites of ageing coal-fired power stations. Today we look into the feasibility of that idea. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.